Now we're going to talk about political leadership with someone who spent a lot of time looking at the lives of leaders across different countries and systems of government. I'm joined by broadcaster Ian Dale. Through the books he's edited and various podcasts, he's explored the lives of prime ministers, American presidents, British monarchs, dictators from around the world, and most recently, Taoiseach. His most recent book, The Taoiseach, A Century of Political Leadership, looks at the 16 men, and they are all men, who have served in that role since the foundation of the state. You're very welcome to The History Show, Ian.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with prime ministers. That's where you started this journey, this multi-volume project on leadership. Sir Robert Walpole is considered to be the first British prime minister. Why is he, does he have that signal honour?
Well, before 1721, so it's like 300 years ago, the Prime Minister of the day was always referred to as the First Lord of the Treasury because they were effectively Finance Minister, Chancellor too. But he was Prime Minister for 21 years and he became so dominant in the whole system of government that he was referred to by many people as Prime Minister. He didn't like it because he regarded it really as a bit of an insult. And the term started to be used a bit more after that. The first time it's mentioned in legislation, believe it or not, was 1906. And the Prime Minister nowadays is still referred to as the First Lord of the Treasury, but that title has really fallen into abeyance.
And the Prime Minister of Britain didn't always hold the same type of power that they do today. How did the role evolve into the modern prime ministerial role, where everything seems to be focused on and centred on Downing Street?
Yeah, and latterly, I would say prime ministers, since probably John Major, Tony Blair, power has been centred on Downing Street. Every government decision has to be run through the centre, and I think that's the same with the office of the Taoiseach, because it's developed in a way that mirrors the role of the prime minister to some degree. Back in the 18th, 19th centuries, the key relationship for a prime minister was with the monarch of the day. And particularly in the 18th century, you had to keep the monarch happy because they had the power to dismiss you. Now you have to keep voters happy, which is probably just as difficult.
But there would have been some prime ministers who would have had fairly toxic relationships with the monarch. I mean, I'm thinking of Gladstone and Victoria. She loathed him.
Yeah, because there was always the contrast with Disraeli, who made every effort to charm her, and he was very successful at it. Whereas Gladstone was much more formal, he was a very austere character. Look, most relationships in politics are built on personal relationships. If two world leaders get on, then their countries are going to get on. If they don't get on, then there's trouble ahead. We've got so many examples of that. It's the same in domestic politics. It's the same in the relationship between the monarch and the prime minister. I mean, Queen Elizabeth had her favourite. She got on very well with Harold Wilson, didn't get on so well with Boris Johnson.
Do British prime ministers tend to be that much more powerful because coalition governments are almost unknown in the UK, or are British political parties effectively coalitions anyway?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's a very good point, because I think most political parties have a broad spread of opinion within them, and it's the same in any country. I mean, you look at the political outlook of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I mean, they're actually not that different, but within the parties, there are strands of opinion. It's the same with the Conservative and Labour parties in Britain. And you look at the way politics is developing in Britain now, where Reform UK effectively has emerged out of the Conservative Party. You've got the new left-wing Your Party, and to an extent the Green Party, where they've managed to take people out of the Labour Party. So there's always a flux in politics. And the power of the centre is probably more than it's ever been. But a prime minister only rules because they have the support of their own parties. We had an example recently where Keir Starmer wanted to give the Americans permission to use our air bases to launch raids on Iran, but he was prevented from doing so by several members of his cabinet because he couldn't get them on board. So there are limits to prime ministerial power.
We'd assume that Margaret Thatcher was one of the most assertive prime ministers, but was that actually the case, or did she rely more on consensus building rather than being authoritarian?
She didn't like the word consensus. She preferred the word conviction. And she led from the front. She chaired the cabinet, But she gave her views before she asked for the views of all of her cabinet. John Major did the opposite. He would go around the table and then sum up, which is a conventional chairing mode. The modern perception of Margaret Thatcher is that she was quite dictatorial, but actually the reverse is true. She actually liked a good argument within cabinet. She liked to prevail, who doesn't? But she did allow her cabinet ministers to do their job. She didn't monitor every single decision that they made in the way that modern day prime ministers do. If you're Secretary of State for Health, she let the Secretary of State for Health get on with running the health service. Whereas now, we're streeting our current Secretary of State for Health. Everything has to be referred to officials in number 10 before we can go ahead and do them.
So with Thatcher, it wasn't quite like the spitting image.
I mean, look, every politician has a caricature, and there's always some element of truth in the caricature, but the caricature is only a sort of percentage true. And yes, she was very strident. Yes, towards the end of her time in office, she became very regal, but it was all a bit of an exaggeration.
Now, you've covered US presidents, UK prime ministers, dictators, monarchs. Why the Irish Taoiseach? I mean, pretty far down the international political food chain, you know. Why not prime ministers of Luxembourg, for example?
You do yourself down. No, the reason was that I was watching a series on Netflix called Rebellion, all about the Easter Rising. It was done by RTE. And I assumed, in my naivety, that it would probably be fairly anti-British in tone. It was a drama. It wasn't at all. It was very fair. And I thought to myself, why do I know so little about Irish politics or Irish history? So I began to read up, sort of watch other documentaries, and I became sort of fascinated with Irish politics. So that was really the reason I put this book together. And my next book is going to be on this day in Ireland. So it's going to be sort of one page per event on a particular day in Irish history. So the obsession is continuing.
Oh, very good. Now, obviously, you're aware of the fact that through one of our great political experts, political professors, political analysts, Brian Farrell, we have this notion of the Taoiseach as chairman or chief. And I think you've already said that in Ireland, that there's a similar pattern to the pattern, obviously going back much further in the UK, but there is a similar pattern to the way that the prime ministership has developed.
Yes, I think you look at the number of people employed by the office of the Taoiseach now compared to what it was in the 1950s or 60s, and it's grown exponentially, just as the number of people who work in number 10 Downing Street has grown. But I think the basics are still very similar. You are still chairman of the cabinet. Obviously, in Ireland, you have almost permanent coalition politics. So I think that's the main difference between your system and our system, obviously as a result of your electoral system. And when you've got sometimes 3-4 parties that you have to keep happy, it can lead to sort of more unstable government. And we see that in Israel, for example, where Netanyahu has to form a coalition maybe of 5, 6, 7 parties, some of them very extreme. And that's always been the case. And yet there's no real movement for a change in the electoral system there, which I always find weird. And I don't think there is in Ireland as well.
Now, you said that leaders reflect their times and that we get the leaders we deserve. Does that imply that in Ireland, for example, character is less important than circumstance?
I think in Ireland and the UK, what you tend to do is if you have a charismatic prime minister or Taoiseach, they're then usually followed by a fairly dull one. And then you have another charismatic one, and then you have another dull one. If you look back to, certainly in Britain since 1945, that has tended to be the case. I mean, it hasn't quite been right recently, because when Boris Johnson was prime minister, I always thought, well, Keir Starmer is going to be the next prime minister, so he will keep that tradition going. But then, of course, we had Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak in the interim. I mean, each prime minister has a unique style, and some of them are more appealing to the electorate than others. I mean, I would say, for example, I mean, Leo Varadkar, I think, had an easier, more populist style than Micheál Martin does. I mean, Micheál Martin, I think, in some ways, is very like Keir Starmer, somebody who sort of looks very competent, is calm, is collected, is never going to set the world on fire, but I think generally commands quite a bit of respect, even from his opponents.
As an outsider coming in and learning about Irish history, what do you make of our Civil War divide?
In a way, it's still odd that it still exists, I suppose. I mean, it is obviously a century, well, more than a century ago now. And I think the fact that the two parties are still divided in that way is slightly odd. I mean, to be influenced by an event that was 100 years ago. But when I've been doing the research for the current book, so much of Irish politics, Irish society nowadays is dominated by the results from that period. And I think probably for a Brit, it may be quite difficult to understand, but everything seems to have emanated from that. You had the Progressive Democrats formed in the 1990s, but they didn't last very long. They seemed to me to be a much more traditional, small state, socially liberal party, which I would have thought would resonate more with the times. And you look at the way that Irish society has developed over the last 30 years with the different referendums, the different changes in social legislation, you would have thought a party like that would have actually been quite successful, but obviously it didn't last that long.
Which then of our Taoiseach stands out for you as the most consequential? I'm going to ask you to remove Eamon de Valera from your thinking because, you know, he is, I suppose, essentially the most consequential of all. But forgetting about de Valera, which of the other 15 do you think has been the most consequential?
I would say possibly Sean Lamass, because although he wasn't Taoiseach for that long, I think it was 6-7 years, I think he laid down the foundations of what was to follow. I think he was quite, although in some ways quite an austere character, quite an inspirational character for many. And I think he saw which way Ireland should go. I mean, the fact that joining the European Economic Community, for example, in 1973, he wasn't Taoiseach then, but I think without him, that might not have happened. And I think that's been incredibly consequential for Ireland and also with the relationship with the UK. So I think he would certainly be one of the, shall we say, older Taoiseach that I would point out. I think of the current crop, I mean, Bertie Ahern, who in this country we think of as a sort of very great man, but most people in Britain don't know the circumstances of his departure from office. And in Ireland, I think he's seen as very, very different how we see him in the UK. I mean, we would think of his role in the Good Friday Agreement as absolutely crucial, and therefore everything else sort of is subsidiary to that. But I think given the whole sort of economic development of Ireland during his period, I think he's probably the most consequential Taoiseach of modern times.
Now, you've also looked at American presidents, a very different kind of role. How does the US presidency or the US president vary from other ruling chief executives, as it were?
Well, everyone thinks that a US president is a quasi-dictator, and with the current incumbent, I suppose you could be forgiven for thinking that. And indeed, in the foreword for the Dictators book, Professor Ian Robinson from Trinity College Dublin, he wrote a piece on the psychology of dictators and explained how, although Donald Trump is not a dictator, he certainly has a lot of the personal traits of a dictator. I mean, the Constitution of the United States, it was written very carefully, and all the different amendments that have followed have been absolutely crucial in effectively balancing the different arms of government, whether it's the executive, the legislature, or indeed the head of state. And that hasn't really changed much over the years. I mean, Donald Trump is pushing at the boundaries of a lot of those things, but in some ways, he is still restricted by some of the powers that were given to the president in the American Constitution of 1776.
I mean, they refer to it as the bully pulpit. What do you interpret that phrase? How do you interpret that phrase, bully pulpit, in terms of the influence at the very least, whatever about the power, but the influence of the American presidency?
Well, to me, that term means that the president is there to reflect the mood of the nation, to represent the nation. And some of the best American presidents have used that to their own great advantage. Ronald Reagan, I think, would be one. Abraham Lincoln, another. Theodore Roosevelt, another. People who sort of embody the whole sense of what being an American is. I mean, it's a bit different for a Taoiseach or prime minister because they're not the head of state. So they're not there to necessarily have the same sort of emblematic symbols that an American president does. And I think that the American presidents that have failed have generally been those ones who haven't really been able to rise to the occasion. I mean, Jimmy Carter, who I think after he left the office, his reputation was much better than when he was actually acting as president. He just didn't have this sense of optimism that Reagan exemplified. I remember that morning in America phrase that Reagan used, whereas Jimmy Carter was associated with economic malaise. I think if you go back in history, even going back to the 19th century, those presidents that exuded optimism, were able to articulate the sense of American destiny, they were the ones that actually succeeded.
We've had 250 years of American independence, not quite as many years of American presidents. But when you look at all of them, who, in your opinion, was the greatest American president?
Lincoln, without a shadow of a doubt. I think any historian would come to that conclusion. American academics often draw up lists of sort of, well, the best and the worst. And the best always include Lincoln, both of the Roosevelts. I mean, Kennedy scrapes in sometimes, but I always think with Kennedy that he only scrapes into these lists because he was assassinated rather than for what he actually achieved. And he was only president for 3 years. And when you look at his achievements, I mean, there weren't that many. The Vietnam War effectively started under his presidency. He didn't do much on civil rights. It was Lyndon Johnson that did that. So there's always a good debate over who's the best and who's the worst.
Okay, well then, that's my follow-up question. Who is the worst? Who are the candidates, at least, for worst president?
Well, Richard Nixon is one that a more recent one that often comes to mind in this. I have to say, I'm fascinated by Nixon. I think without Watergate, and I know you can't take it out of the equation, but if you do take it out of the equation, I think he would have been in the top 10 presidents, both for his domestic policy and indeed his foreign policy. He was the creator of détente. He opened up relations with China, started to bring the Vietnam War to an end. So I think he had a lot of achievements, but you ask most Americans and they would put him way down the bottom of the list. You go back in time, and I think Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, might be on that list too. But then there were quite a few that only lasted one term in the 19th century. Rutherford Hayes, James Polk, ones that frankly most people have never heard of nowadays.
This would be the mid-19th century nobodies, basically.
Yeah, and there were quite a few of them, to be honest.
Franklin Pierce, a name to conjure with.
Yeah, and what the thing is, when you do books like this, I mean, even I, as an ultimate political geek, I mean, there were some presidents I had literally never heard of. There were a few prime ministers I'd never heard of. Editing books like this, you really do learn a lot about your own country's history and that of other countries. And the great thing is, if you're doing a book of essays of sort of 47 American presidents or 55 British prime ministers, you don't want to read biographies of all of them. So you do sort of 10, 15 pages on each. And the idea is that then if somebody's particularly captivated by one of them, they then go and read a proper biography of them.
You've done prime ministers, presidents, dictators, monarchs, Taoiseach. I believe somewhere on the horizon is generals. Are you a military historian?
I'm not a military historian at all, which has made me rather apprehensive of doing this book, but it's been an absolutely fascinating experience. It's coming out on the 5th of June, and it's 69 generals from history going back to the days of ancient Rome. I mean, obviously, there's more British and American generals in there than any others. And a lot of the ancient ones I literally knew nothing about, but I know a lot of people that do know a lot about them. So, and that's the joy of these books, putting the jigsaw together, recruiting the author to write about a particular subject.
What about Taoiseach, who don't seem to want to write about themselves? I mean, it seems to be obligatory for American presidents, UK prime ministers, we have to write a memoir. That's what we settle down to, and we spend the first 2 years after we get booted out or we retire or whatever, and we write our memoir. Not so popular amongst Irish Taoiseach for some reason. Do you think there's any particular reason for that?
Well, I don't know is the honest answer. It does seem really odd because, as you say, it's almost a rite of passage. Certainly in this country, every prime minister writes a book. And I think they should, just for historical purposes. You want to know, well, they were there. They were sat at the table. They were at the centre of the decision-making process. I want to know doesn't everyone want to know what Keir Starmer really thinks about Donald Trump? Well, we're only going to know that when he writes his memoirs. And I mean, I think, well, obviously Leo Varadkar has written one recently, but I think he's, is it the third or the fourth to do so? Which is very, very odd. I mean, Sean Lemass, there's a new sort of autobiography of his that's just come out based on some recordings that
that's
he
Ronan,
did.
That's Ronan McGreevy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I haven't read that yet, but I'm going to. I think that should be quite fascinating. But it is a shame that a lot of them haven't. I mean, the ones that are still alive now, I mean, I would like to read Enda Kenny's memoirs.
You actually rate Enda Kenny, don't you? Very, very highly.
I do. I think he took over at a very, very difficult time. And I think he really stabilised Ireland in the financial sense, in the economic sense. I think also sort of some of the social legislation that was passed when he was Taoiseach is obviously very, very important. So I think he's another one, a bit like John Major in this country. I think they're going to be seen by historians as much more significant as than maybe contemporary commentators would say.
I could talk to you all day, but we'll have to leave it there. Ian Dale, most recent book, The Taoiseach, A Century of Political Leadership, published by Swift Press. We look forward to the Generals coming out in June. And by the way, Ian will be appearing at the West Cork History Festival in August. Ian Dale, many thanks indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you.